Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sorrow Gone Rogue, where we look at all things politics, local, national, and international. And obviously, international has been a very big feature of the news of late, and particularly on this station, which has done sterling work looking at the attacks by the USA and Israel on Iran, and the where to's, the why for's, and the how's this has involved. And of course, military strikes on in a place like the Middle East affect global markets, and oil prices are surging, unsurprisingly. Gold is soaring, and the rand is weakening, and volatile mix could filter through to local petrol prices, which, as I understand from tomorrow, will be higher. On the other hand, a plus is that the inflation that will rise with it will simultaneously boost certain South African export sectors. Now, the Investec has said that the attacks launched on Iran had translated into roughly a 12% rise in the rand oil price to about 1,294 rand a barrel on Monday. And if dollar exchange rates stay current and the oil price remains near $80 over a barrel over March, the fuel price could increase by about 9% month on month. This would obviously have an impact on inflation and on the cost of everything that we would have to bear. I mean, there is nothing like the price of oil going up to have those effects. The South Africa's current inflation rate stands at 3.5% year on year, and had been expected to decline further prior to these potential fuel increases, because it had been helped by fuel price reduction. So the risk now is that higher oil prices and further rand weakness could stall that progress and possibly reserve it. So while the temporary spike may be overlooked by the Reserve Bank, a sustained increase could change the interest rate outlook. South Africa's exposure to fuel price hikes is amplified by its dependence on imported fuel, as our domestic capacity to refine locally has shrunk significantly after three of our six oil refineries closed in recent years. Most of our crude is imported from the US, followed by Ghana and Nigeria. And South Africa last imported crude oil from Iran in mid-2012, when Western sanctions related to Iran's nuclear program halted trade. So what's been around has gone around, and it seems to be coming around again. However, refined fuel imports are also heavily tied to Gulf-linked supply routes, and of the roughly 4 billion litres of petrol imported into South Africa in 2024, the largest share came from the UAE and India, while diesel were dominated by Oman, India, and the UAE. So whatever we can assume, everything is going to become much more expensive.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We're starting to see talk about the change to the leadership positions in the Democratic Alliance and in the African National Congress. Now, the DA leadership races offer some glimpses of how the party might position itself in future. And as had been widely anticipated, Jordan Hill Lewis, who is the mayor of Cape Town, announced on Friday that he would run for the position of party leader. And it seems highly likely that he will run uncontested. Three of the four priorities he named in his announcement suggest that he will pursue some subtle shifts in emphasis if he's elected to the leadership. The first priority is a continuity claim. The DA must continue to govern well where it does govern. And other than that, three areas of change he sees as rooms for improvement. The first is that the DA must get better at creating a connection with the millions of South Africans who have never voted for us before, says Jordan Hill Lewis. He points out that many people see the DA as distant and feel a disconnect, which the DA will have to address if it wants to grow. The second issue which he feels has to be addressed is that the DA should play a more assertive role within the government of national unity. So while endorsing the party's decision to join the GNU as having been the correct decision to make, he says that a DA that drifts along quietly inside the GNU is weak, and vows that a DA under his leadership will work to shape the direction of government. I think this is intended, and importantly so, to send a message to DA supporters who are perhaps becoming somewhat concerned that the DA is being co-opted by the ANC, and possibly signals a new chapter in the nature of the GNU and how the DA and the ANC are going to relate to one another. The third priority he identifies is the lack of a purposeful and positive vision for South Africa. There is a strain in our politics that thrives on decline. That says the country is finished, that nothing can be fixed. Hill Lewis rejects that defeatism. He vows to restore hope, and he wants the DA to promote a can-do mindset and a willingness to confront problems head-on. He drew an interesting the distinction between the DA and other groupings that promote cultural, ethnic, and regional divisions between South Africans by saying that such individuals and parties, quote, keep telling us that one group or community is the problem, or that these are the ones you should blame. In contrast, for him, the DA's vision is one of a South Africa filled with good people who share many of the same values, which I think is true, and want the same thing. A country that works better, and a sense of hope that our future is getting better. What this will mean in his taking over the leadership position with regard to continuing to run the city of Cape Town, and whether it will be handed over to a new mayor, I'm unaware of, and is yet to be seen. And there is obviously a question mark as to whether both positions can be filled adequately by one person. Jordan Hill Lewis has a considerable reputation as a politician, and certainly has, I think, the confidence necessary to both go for the position and to ultimately be part of the decision making that decides what's the best thing to do for the DA and for South Africa. So whether there will be anything different or anyone new coming in to challenge Jordan Hill Lewis, we've yet to see, seems unlikely, but that's the way that things run. Now, the ANC's own leadership election is a long way off, and it's only scheduled for the end of 2027. But we're starting to see maneuvers beginning, rumours swirling that mining magnate Patrice Motsepe, who has always kept a very low profile on the political stage of the ANC, and was an early beneficiary of the ANC's black economic empowerment policies. He also happens to be President Cyril Ramaphosa's brother-in-law, will run for ANC president. Now, a new website was launched last week at the address pm27.org.za, which describes PM27 as a, quote, movement to rally South Africans behind Patrice Motsepe, the purpose being to promote Mr. Motsepe as the most credible, unifying, and visionary leader to guide the ANC and South Africa into a new era. What's unclear, and nothing is being said, denied, or admitted, is whether the site is backed by Mr. Motsepe, and his people are not coming forward on that either. In polling that was done by the Social Research Foundation in November 2025, Mr. Motsepe was the preferred pick for the ANC leader, with 22.5% of all respondents supporting him. He was followed by the party's Secretary General, Fikile Mbalula, Bucks, at 18.5%, and Deputy President, interestingly, Paul Mashatile, at 13.3% in third position. When respondents were asked who they thought stood the best chance of becoming leader, Mr. Motsepe was chosen by 21.8% of the respondents. versus 19% for Mr. Mashatile and 70% for Mr. Malula. So there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect there one way or the other. But Mr. Motsepe still seems to be ahead. Now, both Mr. Mashatile and Mr. Mbalula represent entrenched party establishment and have a very significant and mixed experiences within the ANC. Mr. Motsepe, however, is seen as a relative outsider, and this could put him and his track record of being successful in business, particularly in the area of mining, in good stead in a party that may face a real challenge from a party like the DA. There seems to be a great deal of disgruntlement over the way the ANC has been handling things and less willingness to give the ANC the chances that they've been given in the past to get things right. So he might be the right person with the right clean profile if the party concludes that it needs a new broom to clean out the rot, and rot there is plenty of it, and restore it to its winning ways, which, bear in mind, it's been in power for good or ill for the last 31 odd years. On something completely different, but very much in tune with where we're at the moment, in so many of our, so much of our news, if you want to call it that, because it's singularly depressing. It's a theme that's been running through everything that we see when we open the newspapers these days, is people being done out of money in one form or another. And the current is, one of the current no goodnesses is, our soldiers being embezzled by senior soldiers. About 50 million rand of soldiers' mandatory monthly contributions to the SA Army Foundation have been embezzled. And the money was allegedly used for, among other things, providing top generals with credit cards. So we will look at that.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This morning we are going to speak to Chris Hutting, the Executive Director of the Centre for Risk Analysis. Chris, you are going to talk to us today about the budget, and the budget being the government budget. Silly question, perhaps. First of all, do governments need budgets? What do they do in setting out a budget?
I don't think there are any silly questions in economics or government fiscal policy, except when you're a policymaker. Then you ask many silly questions and you possibly make very silly decisions, given that they spend taxpayer money. But I mean, similar to a household budget or an individual's budget, the idea is that you are supposed to figure out and track your income and your expenditure. So those two very basic things. Now, states, governments have all sorts of priorities that they ostensibly want to do for the people or for society. So education, healthcare, small business support, all that sort of stuff. But all of it needs to be funded by tax money at the end of the day. So governments can, of course, just print money, but that's a whole other issue. So those governments that want to do it as relatively responsibly as possible, they try and collect revenue through taxes, through VAT, through excise duties, through all sorts of receipts on exports and imports, all that kind of stuff. And then they spend it on given priorities. So your given government ideally should focus on, you know, certain key issues in a country's interest. So basic service delivery, national defense, the sort of business environment. I guess where we start to encounter troubles is where governments try and do much more than that, as South Africa's government tends to do time after time after time. I'll just add a last note. My ideal national budget covers three criteria. So it is focused, it is boring, and it cuts taxes. And based on those three, last week's budget to me was relatively better than budgets we've seen for the last 5 to 10 years. By no means perfect, but relatively better.
And why do you say they're relatively better? What's been the difference this year compared to the average year preceding this? Sure. Has the government brought in more than it's spent? Is it still spending more than it's brought in? Is it less than we risk it being? What's the scenario?
Yeah, our debt trajectory is looking better. So keep in mind, I said this with the caveat that National Treasury, they often are overly optimistic on debt, on the debt sort of peak hitting and then declining, and they're always too optimistic on growth. So they always say we'll get 2%, 3% growth, and then we get 1.1 or 1.5, always usually below 1.5. So on the debt situation, it's projected to peak this year and then decline for the next 2 to 3 years. Growth is also forecast to be 1.6% this year and then 1.8% over the medium term. So possibly for the first time in 15 years, if not longer, that we have GDP growth larger than population growth, which means our GDP per capita could increase. On the debt picture, it's helped government a lot that over the last year, commodity prices have been higher, so specifically gold and platinum. We've collected more revenue than was projected. I think the revenue coming in is something like 20 billion rand more than initially forecast or projected. So that gives government a bit of breathing room just on the spending and income side. And then maybe a very last point on the sort of debt and just why I thought it was a relatively better budget. So on the tax matters. So both income tax brackets and medical tax credits, they've been adjusted for inflation and adjusted upwards. So that means, ideally, because you adjusted for inflation, inflation doesn't eat away at your tax, at your income that is collected, where beforehand you might have inflation at 4%, 5%, and brackets aren't adjusted for that. So even though people pay in, they don't see it in terms of returns, just because of what inflation does to income. So in that regard, we didn't see this yet another attempt at a sort of stealth tax. I guess they were just honest about it. And to me, there's something to that. I'm not saying this was the ideal sort of libertarian budget. It's very limited government, limited spending. But from where we've been the last 10 years, it does seem to be still striking a bit more fiscal responsibility.
Okay. So essentially, we see a government that is not excessively spending more than it's bringing in. What has it meant from a point of view of literally of individual income tax rates?
Yeah, so those remain consistent. So as I mentioned, that bracket creep, that stealth tax that we've had the last 5 years, where those tax rates and income brackets aren't adjusted for inflation. They remain there. The tax rates remain what they are, corporate tax rates as well, but they haven't been revised upwards or downwards. So it's not, I also don't want to make it out that this is a radical cut and that, those individuals, those among us who operate in the upper echelons, are going to feel that they're going to see they're going to pay less tax or anything. It's just remaining consistent. Keep in mind an environment where there are spending pressures on things like the public sector wage bill, on the NHI, on land reform, all that sort of stuff. There's always more reasons and temptations to radically try and up the tax take to try and collect even more. But they've still tried to keep somewhat rational or reasonable in that regard.
My impression is that some of those programs have, if they've not disappeared, they've sort of been they're put on hold. There's no sense that there's about to be a great deal of spending in any of those areas, even if they get mentioned every now and again.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. And to link it back to the medical tax credits, I mean, if you remove those, that's such a big part of private medical care, where for those of us on private medical aids, we can then claim back from SARS. You get that kind of incentive system and that kind of relief for paying into a private medical aid. If you remove those, you really start to remove any kind of pretension that you aren't going to pursue the NHI. So as long as those ingredients like private medical tax credits and a few others remain in place, it tells you that despite the rhetoric, there's maybe a realization that this is a fight that they're not going to win. I mean, number one, ideologically, they're still wanted, but just that they're not going to win this fight anytime soon.
Now, the economy, I gather, is expected to grow about 1.6% in this coming year.
That's correct.
Taking inflation into account. And inflation is expected to be around 3.4%. Is it a case where it never really quite gets the growth up to meet the inflationary expectations? Is this a sort of standard fare?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, across the world, I mean, even now, more developed markets, they are encountering more stubborn inflation, or inflation that remains higher for longer. So as long as we get to a state where maybe quarter on quarter, year after year, at least our GDP growth is greater than our population growth, which has been in sort of 1.4, 1.5, 1.6% range. As long as our GDP growth is higher than that, then we're going to see on a per capita basis, the average South African, their wealth or their economic sort of activity increasing. It's a very long time to turn around. If you keep in mind last year, in 2024, GDP per capita was lower than it was in 2008. So just all that time we've spent going backwards and economic activity contracting, like I'm not selling this that to say this budget now portends we're going to get out of that deep hole in which we found ourselves for the last 10 years. But we could start to see a little bit here and there, some green shoots. The policy environment also permitting, of course.
Yes, of course. And where do we see with things like excise duties on things like tobacco and alcohol? Because those always seem to be an area that's favored as a, I don't know if it's a form of punishment because it's they arguably not crucially needed, but highly desired.
100%. There's nothing like a government that, was it Reagan that said, there's nothing as terrifying in English language as a government that tells you, I'm here to help you, I'm here to save you. So the bureaucrats and the policymakers who want to make us healthy, even though we don't want to be healthy. Both the duties on alcohol and cigarettes, those were increased. The VAT, that did not increase after we saw again last year what happened with the four budgets that the government of national unity went through. Minister Gordon Gwana, he did highlight last year that he thought that this year we would have to increase VAT this year and next year because they delayed those increases. But fortunately, the VAT increase didn't happen. That's interesting. But I think South Africa has really been helped by this commodities upswing, this commodity cycle. I do think there's a risk that they think, you know, what's the issue? We're getting 1.6% growth. We survived the tariffs from the US. We're collecting 20 billion rand more than we thought. So there's no real need to do sort of deep policy or legislative reforms. And that just doesn't hold. Like we always ride these commodity swings, but the fundamentals don't change. So this commodities upswing, and let's see what happens, for example, now between the US, Israel, and Iran, I mean, to global energy prices, oil prices, fuel prices. As we record on Monday, the oil price is coming towards $80 per barrel, and it was last week sort of in the $60-$65 range.
Right.
If South Africa continues to sort of hope for these commodities upswings, then we're not going to see the long-term really good economic growth that we need, I think. Fuel levies up as well. And of course, the road accident fund does get more support, which if one talks again about things like reform, you don't understand why something like the RAF, not to say that, I don't know, that you cut support overnight, but that you really hold the line on any kind of accountability, prosecutions, reform. If you look at the corruption that's been occurring in and around the RAF, like, yeah, so increasing the fuel levy and support for those kinds of things doesn't make sense, number one, just from an incentives point of view, but also from an actual outcomes point of view.
In what way will there be an intention in the budget for people to be encouraged to save more?
Yeah, 100%. So tax-free savings, the limit is increased. I think it was now to 46,000, the total, per year. And then also the limit for small businesses. This is particularly interesting, just if you keep in mind, always the talk about red tape on small businesses. So here we had capital gains exemptions were raised, including those on small business sales. So that was from 1.8 million to 2.7 million rand. So trying to sort of incentivize and support savings on the tax-free savings side, and also maybe the compliance and tax costs that are imposed on small businesses. So not direct support, but sort of indirectly trying to stimulate that kind of economic activity.
And what's happening with regard to limiting retirement fund deductions?
Yeah, that's interesting how exactly they're trying to play that and sort of couch that, because on the one hand, you've got the tax-free exemptions, you know, increasing. And then on the other hand, you've got this particular matter on retirement. I don't know how exactly they can incentivize this better, because if you look on the GDP per capita basis again, if you invest in an RA or any of that kind of retirement focused savings in South Africa, that money of yours that you invested over, I don't know, 20, 30, hopefully longer time, was eroded by things like inflation, but also lower GDP per capita because of the value of the rand, economic activity, all that sort of stuff. So they're trying to incentivize it. I just know if you then compare, you know, if you put, for example, money in an RA that's heavily weighted towards South Africa versus overseas, your money would have been eroded over time. So they can do some of these adjustments at the limits, sort of the upper limits. But I don't know if it's going to be enough to really incentivize it.
Now, what's the situation with regard to small businesses only being required to register for VAT? That threshold has been raised, has it not?
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's similar to the what I mentioned earlier on the capital gains exemptions. So on small businesses, that was up from 1.8 to 2.7. And then if you've got these VAT exemptions also raised for small businesses that are below a certain, I think it was a certain turnover, then also you've got the possibility then that you stimulate that small business activity, because small businesses have to then, they're allowed to not spend that time and that cost on that compliance, on human resources, you know, dealing with those issues. You can actually spend it on business activity. So it's, I don't want to undermine it. It's a nice attempt. I just don't know if it goes far enough.
Because I think that it's when turnover now exceeds 2.3 million rand.
Then you get hit,
The note I have is that 60% of government's main budget of 1.95 trillion rand will be spent on what government calls a social wage. Those are what you mentioned at the beginning, education, healthcare, social grants, etc. Should it be as high as 60%? Is it is that a sort of acceptable amount? Should it be more? Should it be less?
No, I think ideally it should be less. I mean, if you look at other developing economies, I mean, developed economies as well, they have social wages, social welfare. But if you're spending around 60% of your budget on the social wage, you need to ask the question about what real economic activity does your country have. I link this also to the unemployment situation, where we had the previous quarter, according to the data released in the last 2 weeks by Stats SA, the unemployment rate, the official rate, did improve. But most, if not all of that, came from public sector employment. So civil service, education, healthcare, schooling, that kind of thing. Not to, again, undermine those services. But your priority can't be there because, number one, it increases the public sector wage bill. So that's a big take, again, of government spending. It increases the incentives for unions, and that's in all sectors and how they operate and how they undermine economic activity and any competition, really, in the sectors in which they operate. And I don't think it's a sustainable trajectory. So if you've got almost 8 million citizens unemployed, if for so many people, a large part of their salary, if you call it that, that they receive in a month is from some kind of grant or social wage. Number one, it's so small. So can it really make a difference just from that point of view, practically? And number two, this discontinued sort of pervasive cycle of dependency on state handouts. Some people use it well, others will take advantage of it, but it's not the kind of robust economic activity that you want, I think.
That's why you always get the mantra from anyone with sort of aspirations to making a dent on how society does, is on achieving employment outside of the government sector, in the ordinary economy, in the civil economy, which has generally not been, as far as I'm aware, has not been the government's forte.
No, that's being very diplomatic. It has not been the government's forte. There is that sort of ideological component of wanting to control economic activity and wanting to force people into those sectors. But it sort of drives fewer and fewer people into that space. And also, if your more robust real economic activity isn't there, What do you expect to get from a fixed investment point of view, from a capital formation point of view? You get less and less of that kind of thing.
What about things, finally, what about something like HIV and AIDS programs? Are we still looking at allocating large amounts or relatively large amounts to try and prevent mother-to-child transmission and to provide antiretrovirals? Or has that situation improved at all? Or do we just take it as a given that there will always be a fair whack being allocated for those purposes?
Yeah, I think it is pretty much taken as a given. There's also for government, they will use the justification that the US under President Trump has put a stop to a lot of that funding from the US side. So to things like PEPFAR. PEPFAR is still continuing in some kind of different ways. But the South African administration government will say, you know, they need to find the resources available. So that reality, I think, unfortunately, continues to persist. It does then, of course, limit the resources that can be spent on things like NHI and other plans, you know, more sort of pie in the sky kind of things, and those resources be allocated. If you need to reallocate what limited resources you have for citizens who need it sort of day to day in the form of things like ARVs, then it's easier to sell that politically than it is, for example, to sell it on other programs. So for now, that situation continues. It really, the budget is indicative of, you know, all sorts of interest groups, of priorities for government, all that kind of thing, probably even more so than the SONA. The SONA talks a big game every year, and there's visions and all that sort of stuff, but the budgets tell you what realities government, not always, but what realities they accept and what they're trying to work with.
And finally, what is your sense of the finance minister, Enoch Godongwana, and his nous as a finance minister in putting together a budget of this nature?
It's interesting, given his background in things like the ANC being, you know, at a few points sort of head of its economic policy, and one would have, you know, seen him as much more progressive, left-leaning Marxist almost, at least in his readings and that kind of thing. And now, given that he's been in this position, it's funny, these departments that are exposed to market forces and international investors, they might talk about radicalism, but then they have to sort of really hunker down and accept these realities. So you see the Reserve Bank doing pretty well in this regard, National Treasury, because they're exposed to these market forces, where departments that aren't, I mean, they can engage in whatever flights of fantasy they might desire. So the minister, it was interesting. I attended the budget in person, and the minister was quite energetic. He cracked jokes all the time, versus the last 2 years where I thought he was quite downbeat, just in his demeanor and his body language. So this time was interesting. Lots of, you know, sort of camaraderie, not only between him and his ANC colleagues, but between GNU partners, saying that this is the budget that is now the sort of produced by a coalition government. Maybe just the last point, I didn't enjoy this as a taxpayer, but at the end of the budget, when everyone, all the parliamentarians, I've never actually seen all of them united in anything, but they all stood up and applauded the commissioner of the South African Revenue Service, Edward Kieswetter, for his work, and of course his term is coming to an end. I thought that was interesting. There's something to that, the kind of respect for these state institutions. So I did try to appreciate it, even though I thought, you know, I wish you weren't that efficient, because you'd be taking less of my income.
Yes, of course. Chris Hutting, thank you very much for that breakdown on the budget, why it is what it is, and how it's supposed to benefit us without detrimentally affecting us too much at the same time. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you very much.
From sunrise to Shabbat, from Johannesburg to the world.
IFM is the glue and a platform that keeps us all together and has grown into a top-class radio station with excellent programming.
This is Chai FM.
Well, an issue I know we've raised before, but I would like to raise again because of the importance and the seriousness of it, and that is the fact that 15% of South Africans can't read a single word by grade 4. Now, a latest report by the Funda Uphumela National Survey for 2030 Reading Panel was published at the end of February, and it includes the first comprehensive data set for early grade reading. The report found that there have been no improvements in the number of grade 4 learners who can read for meaning, with 80% of learners struggling to comprehend what they read. Now, this was the same percentage that was reported in 2025, with absolutely no improvement. The report goes into some detail about how these children are being left behind long before they reach grade 4, with poor results for learners from grades 1 to 3. And the survey found that only 30% of learners between grades 1 and 3 are reading at a grade level. Of greater concern, however, is that 15%, about 15% of learners cannot read a single word by the time they reach the end of grade three. And the correlation, the number worsening correlation, seems to depend on the language of instruction. So with a quarter of Sepedi and Tsitsonga children not being able to decipher one word. So this obviously raises horrific questions about home, particularly in those languages, home language instruction, and the very basic necessity of reading and what sort of resources are available and are used in schools to this effect. The researchers have explained that the survey is the first nationally and provincially representative data set of reading outcomes in grades 1 to 4 in all languages reported against Department of Basic Education outcomes. The former Deputy President of South Africa, Dr. Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka, convened this panel as a way to bring together the country's leaders in an effort to reach the goal of every child in grade 4 being able to read for meaning. Clearly, nothing has been achieved in that respect. And the Minister of Basic Education, Siviwe Gwarube, and the Department of Education launched the survey in November 2025. It appears the department has worked for over 7 years with linguists and data specialists to help develop benchmarks for children from grades 1 to 3 in all official languages. And the benchmarks indicate where learners need to be in their reading proficiency to be able to read for meaning by grade 4. This is the first study measuring these targets, and they're obviously coming up with very poor results in specific areas. The data showed that grade 3 learners in quintile 5 schools, which are the sort of the top quality schools, are almost three times more likely to reach the benchmark than learners in quintile 1 schools. And researchers have said that it's clear that South Africa is far from meeting the presidential injunction that all grade 4 learners should be able to read for meaning by 2030. They acknowledge that there are early signs of momentum at a national level in the Department of Basic Education, with plans to define a new minimum package of foundation phase resources for schools. Now, they've also developed a structured phonics program, which is key to, as I understand, to the development of being able to read at all and then read for meaning, and have announced... but they've announced that national promises and announcements to prioritize reading are not translating into tangible progress. Well, there's exactly the point. So the developing structured phonics programs has some way to go yet in that regard. The medium-term development plan no longer specifically references reading as a goal. The issue of reading competencies is now included under the broader objective of improved educational skills, researchers have said. Now, they haven't said whether this has been before or after these outcomes have been ascertained and give us pause for thought. The 2030 reading panel says that these are both complementary and important, but require distinct and objectives and strategies. And I'm not sure with this lack of clarity whether there's a risk that either is going to be properly pursued with depth or intensity. And it seems like the researchers are a bit uncertain about this as well. But it seems like this most fundamental of skills has got to be more uniformly and successfully expanded over the period.
High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Well, perhaps to look at some internationally intriguing news, if you can call it news at all, but let's see it and deal with it as it comes. I don't know if you recall Jacinda Ardern, who was not that long ago the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Now, New Zealand is often considered being part of that sort of quiet, peaceful part of the world where not a great deal happens, but there seem to be lots of social problems, and it really doesn't feature in the way that perhaps countries like Australia, etc., do in terms of world participation and and involvement. Well, it appears that Jacinda Ardern and her family have been seen looking for property to purchase to move to Australia. Now, that must be quite something when it's known that a country like New Zealand has a high immigration rate because there are lack of prospects for New Zealanders in general and high problems such as drug consumption, etc., that there should be movement from New Zealand to other climes, but I suppose particularly to Australia being its closest neighbour. Well, now we have the former Prime Minister of New Zealand seeking to live and work in Australia and leave New Zealand. And I suppose it's entirely her right to do so, but it does strike me as rather strange that of all people, someone who headed up a state should now be leaving the very state they should have chosen to head up. So you never know. I mean, maybe one will start to see that happen more widely around the world. But it certainly comes as a bit of a shocker. Well, as international news goes, this does not exactly strike the lights out, shall we say? But it does provide a slightly different perspective on what is happening in parts of the world that are. Have perhaps fewer challenges than, say, areas that we are more familiar with in the Middle East. So perhaps we should just wish Jacinda Ardern, the new translocator to Australia in her quest to find alternatives to employment and or better employment in other than her, in her country of origin and former prime ministership. Well, Sorogon Rogue, really, I guess going more rogue than that is unlikely to be experienced. I would commend then that you follow us and join us again next week, and we'll look at see if there's news, particularly news of the world, that can be more pertinently and excitingly brought to us that is outside of the Middle East or and unrelated to the Middle East, failing which we are moving towards local elections which are due to be, if unannounced at this stage, really quite significant. And there will be more manners in which South Africans, particularly the employees of South Africans, are being fleeced by unscrupulous employers by having money stolen that they have either paid or is owed by them for their own use or has been owed to them by their employers. So we'll see those things are likely to come up at least once a week, if not more. So please join me again next Tuesday when we will have a look at political news, local, national and international, on Chai FM 101.9. Keep well. See you then.